This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. JNSPG staff will read synopses of articles which have been published online this week. The full text versions of these articles can be found in the online and print versions of the journal.
Hello and welcome to the Journal of Neurosurgery podcast for October 16th, 2009. I'm Anne Stanford.
And I'm Natalie Pinchem.
We will be reading synopses of two clinical articles, two case reports, and a laboratory investigation, all of which were published online today by the Journal of Neurosurgery. This clinical article is entitled Treatment of Brain Arteriovenous Malformations with High-Flow Arteriovenous Fistulae, Risk and Complications Associated with Endovascular Embolization in the Multimodality Treatment. It was written by Dr. Ishiro Yuki and colleagues. High-flow fistulas associated with brain arteriovenous malformations, or AVMs, pose a significant challenge for both stereotactic radiosurgery and surgical treatment. Although there are numerous descriptions of angiographic characteristics of these lesions, very few studies have specifically addressed the treatment risk of embolizing high-flow fistulas in association with AVMs. In this article, the authors examine the treatment outcomes of multimodality treatment of AVMs associated with large arteriovenous fistulas, paying particular attention to endovascular embolization and its complications. Between 1997 and 2003, 182 patients with cerebral AVMs underwent endovascular treatment in the authors' department at the UCLA Medical Center. Of these, 74 patients presenting with an AVM associated with a high-flow fistula were selected for retrospective analysis based on the findings of superselective angiography. After embolization, 32 patients underwent resection, 33 underwent either stereotactic radiosurgery or hypofractionated stereotactic radiotherapy, and 3 underwent both surgery and stereotactic radiosurgery. 6 patients were treated only by embolization. Immediate and midterm treatment outcomes were analyzed. In 57 of the 74 patients, the lesions were classified as Spetzler-Martin grade 3 or higher. Despite the relatively high Spetzler-Martin grade, complete resection was achieved in all 32 patients in the surgically treated group. In patients who underwent stereotactic radiosurgery or hypofractionated stereotactic radiotherapy, 13 had either complete or greater than 90% AVM obliteration, and 2 had incomplete obliteration. 14 patients with residual AVM underwent repeated radiotherapy. Most importantly, the fistula embolization was safely performed in every patient. Endovascular complications were observed in 4 patients, but in all 4 cases, the complications were associated with other procedures, such as nidus embolization. The authors note that the importance of fistula treatment may need to be emphasized to minimize the endovascular complications and to maximize the treatment effect when a multimodality therapy is used for brain AVMs with large arteriovenous fistulas.
This clinical article is entitled The Small Surgical Aneurysm at the Basilar Apex. It was written by Eric Hauck and colleagues. Aneurysms at the basilar apex represent a unique subgroup of intracranial lesions. First, because of its anatomical configuration, the basilar artery's bloodstream is channeled straight and directly into the aneurysm, which results in the highest rupture rates and more frequent aneurysm recurrence after coiling. Surgery therefore could be the ideal, definitive treatment for these types of aneurysm. However, vital perforators, hair-thin arteries, arise from the basilar apex to supply the brainstem and deep central structures of the brain. Surgical clip ligation requires complete separation of these perforators from the aneurysm to preserve them. Injury to the perforators can result in death, coma, or paralysis. Thus, perforator dissection is risky in larger aneurysms because the aneurysm mass itself restricts the surgeon's view and access to the perforators, unlike a smaller aneurysm. As a result, larger basilar apex aneurysms are frequently treated with endovascular techniques rather than surgery due to risk reduction. However, small basilar apex aneurysms are more common, and definitive endovascular treatment can be prevented by an unfavorable configuration of the aneurysm in relation to the parent artery. The goal of the current study was to reevaluate the outcome of traditional surgery for small, unruptured basilar apex aneurysms as an alternative to the currently more accepted endovascular treatment. For this purpose, the authors reviewed clinical data of 21 patients undergoing surgery between 2000 and 2007 for unruptured basilar apex aneurysms smaller than 7 millimeters. The median age of the patients was 52 years, range 29 to 74 years. All patients had a good outcome. Complete aneurysm occlusion was achieved in 19 patients, or 90%. Two patients, 10%, had a minute residual aneurysm with a greater than 95% occlusion. 80 patients, 38%, had a temporary third nerve paresis, which resolved in all cases. The authors conclude that surgical clip ligation remains an excellent treatment choice for small basilar apex aneurysms. The treatment is definitive and low risk in experienced hands.
This laboratory investigation is entitled Heparinase Expression of Glioma in Human and Animal Models. It was written by Jin Hong and colleagues. Heparinase, a mammalian glucuronidase enzyme that cleaves heparin sulfate in basement membranes and the extracellular matrix, serves multiple functions in both physiological and pathological conditions. The overexpression of heparinase has been found in a variety of human tumors. And although this important enzyme has been linked to tumor invasion and metastasis in several tumor types by facilitating tumor cell invasion through the extracellular matrix and basement membrane, overexpression in gliomas has not previously been reported. The authors found that glioma tumor tissues contained significantly increased levels of heparinase, which were thought to be derived from multiple sources, including neovessel endothelial cells, infiltrated neutrophils, and in some cases, neoplastic cells. Heparinase-expressing cells, including tumor cells and neovessel endothelial cells, exhibited a decreased expression of CD44, an important cell adhesion molecule. In addition, heparinase-expressing tumor cells exhibited elevated Ki-67 staining levels as compared with non-heparinase-expressing tumor cells, suggesting that heparinase expression is correlated with enhanced cell proliferation. The author's data provide evidence of heparinase overexpression in gliomas, suggesting that heparinase is a promising therapeutic target in these tumors. The inversely correlated expression patterns of heparinase and CD44 imply an unknown regulation mechanism of heparinase on cell signaling pathways. These findings may lead to an improved understanding of heparinase in gliomas.
This case report is entitled Endoscopic Treatment of Distal Choroidal Artery Aneurysm. It was written by Marc Levesque and colleagues. Distal choroidal artery aneurysms stemming from the lateral wall of the ventricles are rare and are mostly associated with Moyamoya disease. Their treatment is difficult because of their deep location. The authors report the case of a 50-year-old woman who was undergoing follow-up for Moyamoya disease after suffering two intraventricular hemorrhages. Cerebral angiography showed an aneurysm located on the left distal choroidal artery. Magnetic resonance imaging also showed that the lesion protruded from the lateral wall of the trigone of the left lateral ventricle. Using MR imaging-guided stereotactic localization, the aneurysm was accurately reached endoscopically and successfully resected from the parent artery. The patient was discharged neurologically intact. To the best of the author's knowledge, this is the first report of a successfully endoscopically treated distal anterior choroidal artery aneurysm. Endoscopic surgery may be added to the armamentarium of procedures used to treat intraventricular aneurysms.
Next, we have a report of five cases and review of the literature entitled Schwannoma of the Greater Superficial Petrosal Nerve. It was written by Abbas Amir Jamshidi and colleagues. Although schwannomas have been reported to originate anywhere alongside the course of the facial nerve, that is, from the intratympanic to the subtemporal compartment, reports of those originating purely from the greater superficial petrosal nerve, or GSPN, are largely anecdotal. In this paper, the authors present their experience with five cases in which all schwannomas arose in the subtemporal extradural region. Frequent clinical symptoms of schwannomas of the GSPN include facial palsy and hearing difficulties. However, in the cases reported here, no facial palsy or hearing disturbances or difficulties in lacrimation and salivation were observed preoperatively. Rather, in this series, headache and eye pain, due either to stretching of the skull-based dura or mild trigeminal involvement, were the most common presenting symptoms. Interestingly, temporal lobe epilepsy developed postoperatively in two of the patients, but it improved within a short time. The authors note that temporal lobe epilepsy may occur as a nonspecific sign due to any lesion irritating the temporal lobe, but it has not been previously reported in association with schwannomas of the GSPN. The authors conclude that schwannoma of the GSPN should be included in the differential diagnosis of lesions located in the anterosuperior aspect of the petrous bone.
Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the JNSPG this week, or to listen to more podcasts from the Journal of Neurosurgery or Neurosurgical Focus, please visit us at thejns.org.